This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new unrivaled league, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Hotline, that's presented by Sullivan Super Service, Pittsburgh's trusted plumbing and HVAC provider for over 50 years. Donnie Chedrick with you until 2, no pomp, no Joe. Austin Bechtold is with me behind the glass. Pony going solo today. Malzi out. The illnesses have crushed those two guys all week. We had not had a full PM team the entire week.
Really?
We were without Pony on Monday. We had the Feed the Need radiothon on Tuesday, so all of us were together, but it still wasn't the usual show. That show takes, you know, a little bit of a different direction, as you know. Wednesday, no Pony. Yesterday, we were on for 1 hour together before Dan Zangrilli hopped in to do the North Shore Tavern leadoff show. And then today, I'm hosting right now, so Charlie is in for me, and Pony is going solo.
And I know Malzi's been going through it this week. Like, he's been really trying to battle the allergies. He's been a good soldier.
He has battled. We go out to the fan hotline right now. We welcome in former Pirates pitcher turned Pirates analyst. Bob Walk is with us on Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan. Bob, you're... big takeaway from how that game finished yesterday. It looked eerily similar to how some things went at the end of 2024.
Well, yeah, I agree with you there. It was very disappointing the way that went there at the end. When we got up, you know, 4-1, I kind of thought, well, the game's over. We're good. You know, we with Skeens out there, but he kind of ran out of gas, to be honest with you. You could see his control was starting to kind of leave him, not you know, the way that leaves some guys, but for Skeens, yeah, he wasn't as sharp as we normally like to see him. And you know, we were just kind of speculating, and you know, we don't know, they're not ever going to just tell you that, okay, this is the number. But you know, were they going to let him throw 90 pitches or something like that on the first game of the year? And that's about what it was. And so surprisingly, he had the leave the game after 5 1/3 against the Marlins, and the bullpen just couldn't get it done. It's something that we saw a lot of last year, and you know, we hope that you know, this is just kind of a one game thing, and it'll be better. It really, you know, I'm going to try and keep all my judgments until we get through that first homestand, and we got 2 weeks of games in, and then I think I'll have a pretty good idea on what the starting rotation is going to be like this year, and more importantly, exactly what do we have in the bullpen. We do have some new faces down there, especially you know, a couple new lefties, but is it going to make a difference? I don't know. We'll see.
And the guys that aren't new faces, the familiar faces that are in the back end of that bullpen, Bob, and I know you said you don't want to jump to things until we get a few games into it here, kind of a scary sight for Pirates fans yesterday, seeing Colin Holderman look the way he did at the back end of last season, and really for David Bednar looking like he did in all of 2024. And the way that they finished that game, we see two guys that normally pitch in the highest of high leverage spots not only blow the lead, but then lose the game entirely?
Yeah, I think it really, for Bednar especially, he's going to be under a microscope here early on in this season, and really early on in the month of in April. That's when he's going to have to prove that last year is just going to, you know, be a blip on the radar. But you look what he has done before last season. He was so good. He was outstanding. He was at times one of the top two or three relievers in the game. You look at his numbers and what he was accomplishing every single night. And then last year came about, and there's, you know, all kinds of different excuses. And I'm sure that you've talked to him, and you know that he's not a person that would ever make an excuse about anything. So it's hard to really pull out of him what he thinks was wrong. He just says, hey, I wasn't good, and we need to move on, and I need to be better. So that doesn't really give you a whole lot of information as what happened last year. But you look at his stuff, and it looks fine. And even the pitch that they beat him on is 0-2, and he tries to come in and up and in on a lefty with a upper 90s fastball, and he puts it up and in, and the guy turns on it and tomahawks it down, a bullet down the line, just fair, game over. And I just shake my head and say, wow, how did he do that? You know, that, and I don't have the answers. You know, last season I had some answers because I just didn't think his command was as good as it needed to be, especially with his curveball. He's always, that was one of the things that made him so good. I've said this many a time over the last, I guess, 7 or 8 months that, you know, he could locate his curveball, locate his splitter, and put a power fastball pretty much where he wanted to. And last year, that wasn't the case. Sometimes it was there, sometimes it wasn't. But I don't think that had anything to do with yesterday's game. They just went up there and beat him, and I don't have an answer for it.
Do you think that he mentally feels like he is under a lot of pressure, given how last season went, and now we're one game into 25, and it looks a lot like what happened in 24?
I would feel that way, and I did at times. I'm not getting the job done, and I need to turn this around. And sometimes I didn't have a lot of answers for myself, and even though he's a very stoic type guy that puts things on his shoulders and he wants to carry the team, it's just human nature to feel a little bit of pressure. And you know, watching him walk off the field yesterday, I mean, my heart went out to him, because he's a way better pitcher than we have been seeing of late, and just a tremendous person and teammate.
One of the big moments of that bottom of the ninth inning was that leadoff triple, but a lot that went into that was O'Neill Cruz just really misplaying the fly ball. Just part of the growing pains for Cruz out in center field, I assume, Bob, but how have you feel that he has adjusted to playing the outfield and playing the really most important spot out there, opposed to him playing shortstop previously?
Well, I kind of, in 24 hours here, no, it hasn't even been 24 hours. I've been battling this a little bit about how, because I was very disappointed, and not as much as that play in the ninth inning, but when he let the tying run in the game go to second base when he threw the ball on the fly all the way home, mm-hmm. That got me right there. I mean, that's not making the right decision. And the decision should be made before the ball ever even gets to you, before the ball's put in play, before the batter gets in the batter's box. You've got to know the score, and you've got to think, okay, tying run's getting in the batter's box. That's the important guy here. That's the guy I got to be concerned with. And he didn't do that. And I think he's in center field because he didn't do that a lot at shortstop either, if you know what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to be a smarter player out there. And now the play in the ninth inning, I'm not in his head, so I'm not sure. Did he just misread the ball, and that's why he didn't bust back to the wall immediately? That's more of a physical error than making a mistake. Now, at some point, he had to realize, I'm not going to catch this. He needed to pull up and play back and get a rebound and not turn a double into a triple. That's the little bit more of the mental part right there. But also, and this might not be on him, I don't know, but normally in a game situation like that, if I'm in the outfield, if a ball goes over my head, it better be a home run. It better not stay in the ballpark. If you know, that's the old play. You got to play no doubles. If it's over my head, it's got to be a home run.
So do you?
And that wasn't the case there.
Do you feel that some of the mistake there was more so on the player, or do you think it's a coaching situation where, like, you know, why don't some of these guys? Because I feel like Cruz isn't alone. I feel like we've seen these mistakes made by multiple members of the team for the last couple of years where they just seemingly don't understand the time and place of the game. Like, the situational awareness isn't always on point.
If he's told, okay, we're going to play no doubles, he's the one that's going to make a decision about, okay, look back at the wall, I can play right here. Anything over my head, I'll be able to get to the wall and catch unless it's a home run. So I'm not going to give a double or an extra base hit, triple in this case, over my head. It's got to leave the ballpark or I'm going to catch it because I'm going to play that deep. So now that judgment of, like, should he be two steps deeper or two steps shallower, that's kind of on him. And there's an area where some lack of experience in the outfield could be showing itself. That he just misjudged, you know, how far he could run. And so, you know, he thought, well, I'm real fast, I'm real tall, I'll be able to get back there and make any catch that on a ball hit over my head. And he didn't judge his distance right when he set up before the pitch was even thrown. You know, that could be a possibility. But, you know, they can't sit there with a pair of binoculars and move everybody like, you know, hey, you got to back up two steps. You got to do this. You got to do that. And, you know, you can see him occasionally. They'll move a guy left or right, but it's hard seeing exactly how deep he is. Now, if he's way too shallow and you can see it, you can get his attention, you know, wave a towel or whatever and motion him to back up and say, hey, you're too shallow. You can't let the ball get over your head. But if it's only a couple of steps, which kind of probably was in that situation, it's hard to see that from the dugout and move somebody back. That's got to be on the player. He's got to know how shallow or how deep he personally, knowing his speed, can play and still get back and make a catch on a fly ball.
Andy Rodriguez, not the cleanest of games at first base for him. But see, here's a case, Bob, where I don't want to throw it a ton on the player. I know that he has experience. He has over 200 innings in his life at first base. But they make the late decision in the spring to have Andy Rodriguez play at first because they wanted to wait to see if he would make the team. And then opening day, lo and behold, there he is out there. It just did not seem like a perfect recipe for having good defense at that spot.
I agree with you. Even though he is very experienced over there, you know, for a young guy, for a guy that's just got to the big leagues, mm-hmm. he's very experienced because he played a lot of first base in the minor leagues. They weren't sure what he was going to be when he got to the big leagues. They liked the bat, so they played him at different places. Catcher, first base. I think they even looked at him at second base a little bit. You know, I don't know, but I know that first base and catcher were two of the main places that they worked in. So him moving to first base because that was a place we had a need, I look at that as a no-brainer. Why he didn't play first base in spring training, I don't understand. I don't know what that decision was made like that for. You know, maybe they just thought that they had people that were going to make the team that were going to play first base. You know, and after Horowitz got hurt, they I think thought, okay, we got this guy, we got this guy, we got this guy. One of those three is going to be our first baseman. And I don't think any of those options panned out in the way they thought they were. And now you're in the last few days of spring training. You've made some decisions of who's going to be on the team. And the last man standing was Indy. And he got no reps over there all spring training because you were looking at other guys that you thought would be your guy. I think that's the way it went. But it would have been much better if he would have been mixed in over there also.
Bob, based on what you saw when Nick Gonzalez hit the home run, he was a little bit lame coming out of the box. The ankle beat up a little bit. Do you think, and I know I'm asking you to speculate here, do you think he'll be able to avoid an IL stint and this is just a couple of day thing, or is it more serious?
Well, I was only in spring training for 7 days this year, the last 7 days, but I worked every game and saw him play quite a bit. And one of the early games down there, he fouled a ball off his ankle, stayed in the game, but then an inning later they took him out. And ever since then, when I've seen him out there, he doesn't look like he's 100%. He's not moving real quick, like he's protecting something, his ankle, I guess. You know, nobody said anything. You don't ask. You try not to, like you just said, speculate on injuries. But obviously last night, he re-aggravated that or whatever you want to say. And it was a problem for him just to get around the bases, and they had to take him out of there. Based on what I saw the last week of spring training, I don't think it's too serious because he was able to play on whatever it was. He was able to be in the starting lineup yesterday, even though he was had a problem with his ankle. I think after the game, they even characterized it as a reoccurrence of a previous problem. And so that kind of, I think, says right there that it was related to him hurting himself a little bit in that last week of spring training. Now, you know, saying all of that, you know, long-winded answer to your question, I don't think he'll go on the IL. If it doesn't respond to some treatment in the next 2 or 3 days, then maybe they'll reassess and maybe put him on the IL. But I think with a little treatment, hopefully he'll be okay.
Bob, if the Pirates have a one-run lead in the ninth inning tonight, who's coming out there?
I have no idea. I mean, I wasn't sure who was going to come out last night. We didn't have it. It was a tie game, so it really wasn't even a closer situation. But, I mean, nobody would really come out and say who the closer was going to be. We just kind of had to wait and see, and I still don't think I was surprised that Santana came in the sixth inning because he did a decent job last year, kind of. Toward the end, we ran out of options, and he went out there and pitched the ninth inning a couple of times and looked pretty good. I thought maybe they'd wait until a little later to use him. But, there's some decisions to be made. But, you know, like I said, when we get done with the first homestand, I think then a lot of these questions will be answered about who's going to be doing what.
Pirates broadcaster Bob Walk. Bob, TV again tonight for you?
Yeah, Donnie, I'm getting a pretty good workout on TV here. I'm getting these first two games, and then I have all three in Tampa. So you're going to have to look at my mug quite a bit, at least during the Opens.
Yeah, and the big thing now, the SNP 360 app finally on Roku, Bob. That was big for me since that's what I roll with at home. So very happy for that. Good luck to you the rest of the way. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for taking the time.
I'm a Roku guy, too, so I'm with you on that. And fumigate that place. Well, yeah, you guys got to kill some bugs around there or something. Yeah, the whole building sick.
Yeah, I feel you there, Bob. So hopefully we're okay. Thanks for taking the time.
All right, Donnie, take care of yourself.
There we go. Fan Twitter, that's brought to you by South Hills Kia in Peters Township. Visit them at southhillskia.net. About 10 more minutes with us today before we pass you along to Andrew Filippone at 2. Charlie Borges will be with him behind the glass. We go back out to the fan hotline. And we will do so 10 minutes before that 50-minute mark, which is brought to you by South Hills Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram on Route 19 in Peters Township, celebrating 50 years in the South Hills. A big pro day in the area today for the Penn State Nittany Lions. We go out to chat with Joe Smeltzer, Penn State reporter from Nittany Sports Now. Joe, it was a bright and early day for you heading to State College. Did you notice any Steelers presence today in Happy Valley?
Actually, I didn't. I think there was a scout, and thanks for having me on, Donnie. I didn't really notice any presence. We were pretty far away from where the scouts were. It was like media, reporters, and families are all broken up. Some places are all in the same area for Pro Day. Pitt's Pro Day was like that. But, yeah, I didn't really see any Steelers presences. I know they've been pretty busy throughout the week with going to places like Mississippi and Columbus, but I didn't really see anybody there. Pat Freiermuth was there, though. That's probably the most notable one, at least, that I saw.
Speaking from one Penn State tight end of Pat Freiermuth to another, Tyler Warren, he did not do anything in terms of workouts today. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. He didn't work out at the combine, and so knowing that, I didn't see there being much of a chance that he would work out at Pro Day either, and that ended up being the case.
Where do you kind of get the feel, Joe, that his draft slot will be? Like, are there some teams that you're already thinking on draft night in about a month? Like, okay, when this team's up, I have to be ready to go because they could be calling his name?
I think the Jets are definitely a good candidate. We both talked about that probably earlier this week, is that, the Jets, I don't think they really have a tight end, and they need all the help they could get offensively, especially with whatever they're going to be doing at the quarterback position. I think the Jets are a good location for him, and he could reunite with Oliver Fashanu. Other than that, the Colts are a place I've seen him projected a lot at 14, which is right towards the middle of the first round. I saw one projection have him go at 5 to Jacksonville, which that would be a surprise. I don't think he's going to go that high. But I think the Jets, Saints, and Colts are probably the three most common teams I've seen. The Dolphins potentially are in that mix too. But, I think his ceiling is probably the Jets at 7, and then his 4 is probably in that 14 middle of the first round range.
If he gets close to pick 21 with the Steelers' fascination over tight ends, and you as a Steeler fan as well, should they have any sort of consideration about going after this guy, even though they are already pretty stocked up at the tight end position?
I don't think so, for that reason. I mean, they haven't even really been using the tight ends they have correctly, Freiermuth being at the top of that list. I get the temptation to take a top 10 quality player at 21, but it's just not a position of need for the Steelers right now. And when the Steelers actually learn how to properly use the tight ends they do have, then maybe that would be more of a temptation. But the fact that they have so many tight ends and that they have a very good number one tight end that I don't think they've used properly, all of that, it just doesn't really make sense for Warren to go.
Talking to Joe Smeltzer, he covers Penn State for Nittany Sports Now. He is at Penn State's Pro Day in State College today. The other highly regarded Penn State product this year is Abdul Carter. It seems like it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. This guy is going in the top 3, and it seems like it will be either 1 or 2. Are you starting to get a feel of the exact spot that Carter could get his name called?
If I had to guess, Sonny, I'd say it'd be Cleveland at 2. For the simple reason that the Titans, and I got to talk with Brian Boldinger a little bit towards the end of Pro Day. He said because the Titans need a quarterback so badly, it's hard to pass up a QB at 1. And this isn't a great quarterback class, but there was a guy, there's a few guys, Cam Ward, Ashore Sanders, particularly Cam Ward. I mean, I don't I can't see any other quarterback going number one. I think if the Titans want a quarterback, which they should because they don't have one, Ward's going to be the guy to go at one. And then at two, I think Carter to the Browns makes sense for a lot of reasons because it's really hard to pass up the possibility of having two generational prospects on the edge. And a good point that I was just kind of thinking about today while I was at Pro Day is that the guy that's running the show in Cleveland now, Andrew Berry, he came from Philadelphia. And how did the Eagles, what was the big reason they won the Super Bowl last season? Dominance on the defensive front. If you have Abdul Carter, you have Myles Garrett. Obviously, you need a quarterback. You need a lot of things if you're Cleveland still, right? But the possibility of having two generational guys on the edge with how that position is valued and how much it helped the reigning Super Bowl champion get to where they are, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's what I would guess if I was a betting man is that Carter's going to go to the Browns with two.
Where do you feel out of overall prospects, not necessarily where they will go in the draft, but if it was like a big board of, if it was the Joe Smeltzer top 50 in the 2025 draft, where would you have Carter and Warren just as overall prospects?
So we're not talking about like what teams need position wise.
No, it just has to do with the player.
I think Carter's the best player in the draft because when you talk about all the other guys that could go number one, you know, it's all about fit. It's all about a team needs a quarterback. Cam Ward would make sense. Or it's about the uniqueness of Travis Hunter, right? He's a guy that we've never seen before playing wide receiver and defensive back. But Abdul Carter is where he is as far as draft talk goes just because he's really, really good at the position he plays. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I don't think there's a player as good at his position as Carter is at his at defensive end. So I think pound for pound, he's the best overall player in the draft. Tyler Warren, I would say he's a top 10 overall talent, maybe that 7-10 range, just with what he's physically able to do and what his versatility is. Obviously, it was a big talking point for our Penn State season. You know, this guy was a quarterback in high school. He's able to run the ball. He's athletic enough to be able to jump over a pile at the goal line for a free 4-yard touchdown. I think I'm pretty confident that Abdul Carter is the best player in this NFL draft, and I think Tyler Warren's the best tight end and probably a top 10 overall prospect too.
Joe Smeltzer, check out his stuff at Nittany Sports Now. Joe, thanks for taking the time, buddy.
Yep, thank you, Donnie.
There we go. Joe Smeltzer, live from State College, talking about two top 10 prospects in the 2025 NFL draft. I think they're firmly in the top 10, and I agree with him. I think that Carter, at worst, is the number two overall player. Austin, I think it's either him or Travis Hunter.
Right.
For me, I think it's easy.
Hunter, just because of the two-way player potential that he has, like if they decide to do that in the NFL, it just probably is going to depend on the team. But yeah, I mean, following Carter as closely as I have, he is going to be the next like TJ Watt, Myles Garrett, Max Crosby type of player, Micah Parsons, that follows in their footsteps.
Social media's biggest loser, that's Malzy. That's brought to you by Awaken 180 Weight Loss. Visit them at awaken180weightloss.com. What's cooking? That's brought to you by your local Geico rep, Tim Hester.
Thank you, Mr. Hester.
Limits, any big weekend plans for you?
I might be going to Penn State to visit my sister. It's the family weekend up there, so I'm not entirely sure yet, but I think I might be going up tomorrow unless plans fall through, and it ends up being me that has to stay home and watch our dog, Muffin.
Oh, that's so exciting.
We'll see. So I'll be up there for a
day. But you might get the short straw and have to stay home.
Yes, that is entirely possible. It's either my dad or I that's going to end up having to make the ultimate sacrifice. We're going to find out.
You guys going to play like rock, paper, scissors, best out of three?
No, I think that he said that he'll go up next year if I go up this year, and that would be okay. So I don't know. We're going to find out.
Well, great stuff today, Austin. A thank you to you. Thank you to the folks who joined the conversation. Thanks to Joe Smeltzer, Bob Walk, Ray Fittipaldo, everyone who helped out with today's show. Andrew Filippone, riding solo. He is next on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. Donnie Chedrick signing off.